This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, in for Terry Gross. For Scott Minerbrook, the problem of race relations has been played out in his own family. His father is black, his mother is white. While his father's family reluctantly accepted his mother, her side of the family completely ostracized the couple and their children. In 1990, Scott Minerbrook decided to go to Missouri to find out who the white half of his family was. He's written a book about his experiences trying to reclaim his family and about growing up in the 50s and 60s called Divided to the Vein. Minerbrook was interested in particular in reconciling with his mother's mother because, as he writes, I couldn't love myself if I hated my own flesh and blood. Let's begin with Scott Minerbrook reading from the beginning of his memoir.
Mine is the intermingled blood of African ancestors, of Scots-Irish farmers who mixed their blood with the blood of Cherokee survivors of the Trail of Tears dispersal, of Choctaw who mixed their blood with the blood of slaves and traveled north to Chicago. These lives form the divided root of my childhood. Their notions of race and family course through the veins of my expectations, hopes, and dreams. My race and my family were always at odds. Osceola, whom I was now traveling to see, was my mother's mother, but my grandmother in name only. I had never claimed Osceola, and she had never claimed me. Osceola was part of my family, but not of my race. My father is black, my mother is white, and the meaning of the two words, family, fell into the rushing waters between the two. Blood was not thicker than these racialized waters. I grew up well aware that if all my relatives were brought together in one room, there would be a race riot. Somebody would call someone else a name, and there would be blood on the walls. The violence of race hate has shaped the divided ground of my soul. Too dark to be white, too light to be black. I've always known that my family's racial quarrels have not done me little good.
What I think is very clear reading through your book is that race is not an intellectual idea. It certainly isn't in your family because it's about blood. Mm-hmm. But thinking of again of the larger society, I think it isn't an intellectual idea. It mm-hmm. has to do with blood and mm-hmm. veins and mm-hmm. bones and, mm-hmm. and appearance and skin.
It has to do with your soul. It has to do with who accepts you and who doesn't. It has to do with the question of how do you frame the ideas of outsiders and insiders? How do you frame the idea and define the word enemy? And how do you go about trying to understand your enemy? And are they truly enemies? Mm-hmm. And it has to do with the question of family itself. I mean, if we've all been raised to think that family is the most important unit, and I didn't, because I felt that my mother came from people who were totally intolerant, and you know, these were the crackers, you know, who would shoot after my my father's family. I used to have fantasies when I was a boy that my mother's mother, father, whose name was Clarence, would go to a lynching and probably enjoy it. I mean, these are the kinds of thoughts that I grew up with as a child.
Why at the age of 40, and this was about 1990, you wanted to go and search out this white grandmother, mm-hmm. Osceola, down in Missouri. Mm-hmm. Why then, do you think, did you want to try to seek her out and to seek out this white family that had been denied to you?
Well, it was just as simple as really deciding that I didn't want to be a hating person, that I didn't want to really be a bitter person. I didn't want to have this kind of racial bitterness in front of me all the time. I wanted to really challenge it and explore it. I wanted to find out, were they truly my enemies or was this in me? And I went down there. I'd always wanted to go, but I was afraid to because my mother had always told me stories about how dangerous it was mm-hmm. to black people. And of course, she was absolutely right. But I'd wanted to challenge my own experience here and to try to redefine myself. I mean, it seems to me that being an American requires that you redefine yourself and that you reinvent yourself.
How did your parents meet?
Oh, they met in Chicago. They were both students. My mother had come from from Missouri and moved to St. Louis, and then from St. Louis went to Chicago, where she was in business for herself. She had a couturier shop. She was, a designer, essentially, mm-hmm. in business for herself, and was really trying to improve herself. Went to Roosevelt University, and my father was a World War II veteran who had come back, you know, and survived, in a sense, the Chicago streets, and was from a well-to-do family. One of the inversions that happened for me because of race was that I always felt that my mother's family were the inferior ones, because how could anybody claim to be superior and reject out of hand somebody simply because of the color of their skin? I mean, it's just the worst. Whereas my father's family, which accepted me, which was a black family, I've always been tremendously impressed with them. My father had gone to West Point Military Academy when I was a kid. I opened up the closet and saw this beautiful tunic and this uniform, and I have two PhD recipients in my family, just very, very brilliant people. And so my whole racial values were turned on their ear. And I really, the way that they met, I mean, was in struggle. Their relationship was born in struggle. One of their early dates, they were both beaten in Chicago, and so this was really a lifetime physical struggle for them. They had a lot of work to do.
Well, and of course, there were laws against interracial marriages.
That's
and,
right.
And in a sense, against
up until 1967.
That's right. I mean, you were born in 1951.
That's right.
The product of an interracial marriage.
That's right. In many states in the United States, I would have been illegal.
Right.
And I've met a lot of
people.
What
does that mean? What would that mean to be illegal?
I would be bastard. I would be born out of wedlock. They would not honor the institution of marriage. So essentially, my birth, in addition to being bastardy and in addition to being, not condoned in the eyes of law, would, in other words, I would exist as a non-person. I mean, America is full of apartheid, and this is really the deep history of the United States, sort of the unacknowledged history of the United States, is the idea that these codes, in the slave codes and the early actual laws in Virginia and Maryland and the early colonies, that there were legislators, landowners, who decided, well, we're going to have to decide whether or not the produce or the children of black unions and white unions are going to be slaves. Will they be slaves? And of course, many of the early laws said that they would, yes, that even the children would be slaves up until the age of 31 or 27. It depended on state by state. But then, of course, these laws were changed so that in many cases you were a slave for life, just like your parents. So, I mean, this race doesn't come from a vacuum. It comes from legal tradition, and it has to do with the idea of ownership.
You talk about your father's family accepting you and making you part of it. Yet you also write that when your father fell in love with your mother, they, quote, thought that this ignorant white girl was out to get their beautiful boy killed.
That's right, yes.
And that it's true, this was a dangerous relationship back in those times.
Yes, it was.
But not something they were entirely comfortable with.
Not at all. And I think that they were, in some measure, justified. I mean, it meant not only that he would be killed physically or that he was put in a very dangerous position physically and would always have to defend himself.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to defend himself mentally against, prejudice by employers, for instance, and physically, but also in the sense of that they might lose him across the color line. In other words, that the privileges that he would enjoy as, in theory, this is what they believed, if he left the black community, would only further isolate him from them, that they would lose him. And that was based on historical knowledge. I mean, the whole experience of race is quite different, profoundly different for blacks as it is for whites. Mm-hmm. Blacks have always accepted whites, but only to a point into the black community, and they've always accepted the children of interracial marriage, but to a point. And the standard in the black community is that you sort of agree to the idea that if you have one drop of black blood, that you acknowledge this racist idea in America, that's ensconced in American law, you are black. But I think that there were all kinds of things that they saw about the marriage that my mother could not see because she was a white woman and she didn't really understand. So the first conversation that my grandmother, my father's mother, Catherine, had with my mother was in Chicago, and she and Catherine asked, first question that she asked my mother was, what race will your children be?
Yeah.
Now, this
yeah.
was not a really nice question. I mean, it was a really very straightforward, a knife of a question. And my mother blew it. She said, well, we'll let them decide. She didn't understand that, for the children of interracial families, a decision, a choice has to be made. And it usually means that the white person in the family has to give up some of their privilege and has to begin to see that there are other possibilities that are open to their child that they were not open to. And this is a tremendously important thing for interracial couples. And I think that my mother didn't understand it. Huh. And my father didn't understand it fully either. I think that they were both always on the pioneer fringe, on the pioneer edge. And really, the book is about pioneers. It's about the pioneer experience. I see my parents as pioneers.
Well, you see them as idealistic, but as you describe it, this was a violent marriage. Your father had problems with drugs and alcohol.
Yes.
He beat his wife. Yes. He beat you. He was a threatening and in many ways a dangerous person to live with.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's any, can you say that's because of the race problems in this country? Does that in part describe the difficulty they had in being a married couple?
Well, yes, and it also describes the difficulty that my father has had and I've had of being a human being. I mean, the most difficult thing that I've had to try to do in the book is to try to pull apart the question of race when it comes to the physical quarrels that they had.
Yeah.
You know, how much of this was because they used race to as a way of not exploring sort of some of the deeper conflicts that they both brought to the marriage.
You say they both used race to avoid deeper personal problems.
Well, yes, and deeper personal challenges. I mean, as an adult, it's not easy to grow. You know, adulthood's not for sissies, and you really constantly have to confront yourself. So, you know, this is where race becomes extremely complex. And my father, you know, had been exposed to drugs as a boy in Chicago as a result of, you know, some of the things that were happening after the Second World War. He'd become addicted to heroin. You know, he was the son of the black elite. And so what's been interesting for me is to sort of see how this happens for people in the black middle class. And this is sort of the things, the taboo, unmentionable things in the black community. I mean, you know, you write about this stuff and the first thing that you run into as well, but black men don't talk about their fathers in public. Black men do not talk about their mothers in public.
Why not?
It's simply taboo. You simply don't do it. It is not done. I mean, the shame of oppression is such in America that, you know, you're supposed to defend your parents. In fact, there's a thing in the black community we call the dozens where, you know, immediately you go to, you know, the jugular and sort of joke around with, sort of flirting with a lot of danger, verbal play and sort of, well, you know, you're never really supposed to get to that point where you say, well, you're your mama. And there are real cultural values in the black community where you don't talk about your parents.
Well, you talk in quite great detail about your parents. Have you broken this taboo? Did you want to break this taboo with your book?
Yeah, I did.
To say this is who they were, and it's in many ways not a pretty picture.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some moments of reconciliation, but it's scary.
Yeah, well, I had a pretty interesting childhood. I mean, my parents were both very, very driven people, very, very successful professionally. We lived in Connecticut. My father moved us from New York, from Chicago, then to New York, then to Connecticut. He was living the dream, you know, and he was living the dream, I came to realize later, for his whole family. In other words, this is sort of what the aspiration of being black and middle class was, to go to Connecticut, to go to Massachusetts, to go someplace where supposedly that the racial barriers were not so visible and not so obvious. And then to go to a place like that and find that the barriers are very much there. We were blockbusters. I mean, we moved into this little leafy Connecticut neighborhood.
Norwalk, Connecticut.
In Norwalk. Yeah. And as wonderful as the experience was for me, it was brutally harsh for my father. I mean, he was very isolated from his family, very lonesome. He had a very complicated relationship with his own mother, who was a very powerful black woman from a powerful family of black women. And, you know, so all the psychological scars that come about from that alone was enough, I think, to make him a little unstable. And I think that when he drank, unfortunately, you know, he just wasn't any good when he drank. I mean, not many people are. So I try to deal with some of these emotional legacies and say, well, what's race in that? And, you know, race at that point, to some extent, becomes kind of a self-limiting or a self-imposed exile. And I think that at that point, that's where their marriage began to really conflict, and was that the things that brought them together also blew them apart, that they couldn't really confront, that they saw themselves as an interracial couple almost first and didn't realize, but that doesn't mean, at some point, it doesn't mean anything at all.
Scott Minerbrook's memoir is Divided to the Vein. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to writer Scott Minerbrook. His book is called Divided to the Vein. From past interviews that I've done with people who come from biracial parents, many of them talk about feeling as if they are spies, is that they can they identify themselves one way, but the world doesn't necessarily identify themselves one way. And many can live and work in the white world, and everyone think that they're white, and yet they think of themselves as black, and feel in a sense as if they are a spy, as if they hear things that someone who is identified as black wouldn't hear. Do you feel that?
Oh, sure. That's a great point. I mean, it's... this is part of the American experience also. I mean, but it works both ways. I mean, one of the things that I learned when I was in Caruthersville was that blacks...
And this is Missouri, too.
Caruthersville in southeast Missouri, where my mother grew up,
right.
Was that, you know, in this experience of sharecropping, where blacks and whites were you know, equally impoverished, blacks were subjected, of course, to certain kinds of laws that whites did not, but were not subjected to. But in many cases... When there was, you know, a lynch mob, or when there was community punishment that was going to be doled out to the blacks, many times it was poor whites who would warn the poor blacks that this was going to happen as it was going on, as it was being, so that they had, that poor whites in many ways helped blacks to survive.
Hmm.
And these are things that we have to really look at very, very closely, I think, in our American history, that, you know, there are all kinds of fascinating attempts at interracial community in this country that we don't look at. Guthrie, Oklahoma, we don't look at these things. But these, there's an ongoing attempt in this country to combine many, many different ideas of culture. And those, unfortunately, have not become the dominant ways of looking at. So race is really about how you see the future, too. It's about whether or not you cling to an idea that really is very partialized. In other words, that the only history of the United States is the history of rich white people. That's nonsense.
Scott, I actually wanted to have you read from the end of your book, and we the book begins with you going down to try to find this white grandmother who had rejected the family, and
right.
Now, like 250 pages later, you do find her.
Yes.
And she's in a nursing home.
Right. Well, this was my second trip. The first trip I'd made, and she'd refused to see me, and I had to think this over for about a year and try to figure it out. And I figured out that she was just as much of a prisoner as I was, and that you know, her prison was her fear, and that my prison had been my fear, but that I'd maybe her example had helped me to overcome my fear. So I went back, and it was very interesting. The black people in Caruthersville, who were well connected in the nursing home, helped sneak me in. To get past, literally get past the gatekeepers and arrange this meeting. So if it weren't for the blacks in Caruthersville, I would never have met her. That's the first thing. But when I did meet her, something happened to me, and I'll try to describe it in this passage. I stood over Osceola and looked at her hands. They were exactly like my mother's, small but strong, with stocky peasant's fingers. My mother had supported a family with those hands, and Osceola had fed her family by chopping cotton with hers. I had always been amazed that my mother could produce such wonderful artwork and clothing designs with hands as unshapely, almost blunt, as hers. Even my mother had called them unsightly, but now they seemed beautiful. As I looked at Osceola, I was amazed to see that my mother had also inherited her small nose. I realized then that this was probably what my mother would look like in her late years, and I felt that in some way I'd been given the gift of seeing into the future by looking at my past. In 20 years, maybe I would look something like this myself, though I nourished the hope that my African and Native American blood would weigh more heavily in my favor.
Hmm. What did it mean to finally see this grandmother? I mean, she's prickly, there's no question about it, prickly to the end, but you were able to have a kind of reconciliation in the nursing home. What did that mean for you?
Well, it was interesting to me that she kept saying that she wanted me to be the messenger. I mean, that she saw my role as being a messenger to her daughter and to tell her daughter, my mother, that she loved her.
Right.
And so that was what my role was. And that, you know, I'd hoped for sort of a more direct recognition of myself. But I had to say that, you know, but that's not the way God intended it, or fate, or, you know, the Furies or whatever intended it. And it turned out that she insisted that my role be one that I did not intend, which was, and that this was simply life. And, you know, you don't always get it the way you want it. And it's okay that you don't. Maybe it's a good thing that you don't always get it the way you want it. And that is another sort of message for me, and that it's another burden for her, and for a burden for my mother.
But I think from that passage, you see your mother and... See yourself
yes.
in your
Yeah, I could finally see that, you know, that the connection in some sense had been unbroken there. I mean, that it had sort of been closed, that the circle was closed, because, you know, these things of race are just pure nonsense. And, you know, there are survivals across generations of looks and quirks and yawning and snoring and little
and
things like that, and food and, you know, whatever, you know, right. Club toes and all that stuff is, you can't avoid it. You can't avoid your history.
Scott Minerbrook's memoir is Divided to the Vein. He's a national correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. This is Fresh Air.